Please turn to Nehemiah chapter 1. Nehemiah chapter 1. We're continuing our study this morning that we began last week. For those of you that were not here, let me bring you up to date. This is the study of a man who, in our terminologies today, came from rags to riches. He went from a nobody to a somebody. He's a leader. He is a very astute businessman. He's very successful. He's an influential advisor. His name is Nehemiah. Now, if you remember last week, Nehemiah is the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, the king with the great name, Artaxerxes. Every time I have to read that name, I get tickled. It's just a little bit different than anything that we name our kids today. But he's cupbearer to the king. He lives in a city called Susa. That would be the Washington, D.C. of our country. He lives near the king. He's the king's advisor. But he's an Israelite. Interestingly enough, here's a man, this is not his home nation. Again, to remind you, last week we saw Israel got into sin. God had to judge them. He took them out of Jerusalem. He took them to Babylon. King Nebuchadnezzar came in and literally bulldozed Jerusalem. Leveled the city. Leveled the walls that city had, as cities back then did have. Leveled their temple, their place of worship. They had nothing left, and they were taken on a death trail some 600 to 800 miles over to Babylon. Years later, Babylon is overthrown and the Medo-Persian Empire comes into being with King Darius. And Daniel is all a part of that. And this is the Assyrian Empire, as I mentioned earlier, where Jonah was involved in. All of this fits together. Well, Nehemiah is one of those that has been taken from Jerusalem to the Medo-Persian Empire. He's there. He has proven himself to be a very capable leader. And he has become second in command. He's the right-hand man to the king. He's the cupbearer. He's the person the people have to go through to get to the king. If they want the king to do something, they go and they talk with Nehemiah first and say, "Nehemiah, what do you think about this? Will the king accept it? Will he reject it? Should we reformulate it before we present it to him?" He's a very powerful businessman. But it tells us in verse 1 of chapter 1, Nehemiah is writing this. It says, "The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. And it came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace, that Hanani, one of my brothers," I think a physical, literal, his brother, "came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, who were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem." He's asking about the people that are 600 miles away. He says, "What condition is Jerusalem in?" "And they said unto me, the remnant who are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire." Well, this is what he didn't want to hear. He knew things were in bad shape, but he was hoping after all these years that he's been in captivity that hopefully things were in better shape. But he finds out the walls are still in shambles. They still look like they did when Babylon came in and devastated it. And the temple has been partially rebuilt, but it has absolutely no protection. There's nothing to keep the enemy from coming in and destroying it again. He hears the report, and it's not good. The people, as it read here, are in great affliction. The word affliction carries the idea that they were being made fun of. They were being ridiculed. They were being made fun of because they were Jewish people. And you can imagine, people are saying, look at your wonderful city, Jerusalem. Look at all the great things you've got, tongue in cheek. It looks terrible. And I want you to see Nehemiah's reaction in verse 4. It came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and I wept and I mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. I believe in the next verses that we're going to look at, he's going to pray to God in about 6-7 verses here in our Bibles. And I believe we're going to see Nehemiah as he begins to develop into a leader that God is going to use to go back to rebuild the walls. He is going to be used of God to provide leadership to a people that have not had leadership. And they are craving for a spiritual leader to come in and to take control. Remember my definition last week of a spiritual leader? Remember my illustration with Teddy Roosevelt? Teddy Roosevelt was asked, when someone was complimenting on him, he said, "My, you're such a great man, such a great leader." Teddy Roosevelt said, "I am not a great man." He said, "I'm just a very normal man who's very highly motivated." You see, that's what we need today. We need men and women who are godly men and women who are highly motivated to do a work for God. We've got a lot of people who love God, but we have very few people who are motivated to do something with what they know. And Nehemiah is thinking about how terrible the situation is in Jerusalem and what a terrible testimony that is to the ungodly nations. And God's beginning to work on him. And we're going to see a man become very highly motivated. And here we see his leadership begin to develop. And although he is a very high-ranking official, he has a very tender heart toward God. Think in your own lives and think of people that you know. Isn't it true that seemingly it is very tough for a very high-ranking person in the world today to also remain very tender to God? You see someone and they're on fire for God and they're doing great things, and as they begin to climb the ladder in their work because they are so good at what they do, it seems they begin to lose their tenderness toward God. I don't know if it's as the salary goes up they become more self-sufficient or what it is, but it's so rare to see people who continue in their spiritual walk. But it doesn't have to be that way. We're going to see a man who stays tender to God. Now, there are four factors in chapter 1, the beginning of chapter 2, that we're going to look at this morning that reveal themselves that I believe are going to be, if you want to become a competent spiritual leader, these things need to be taken into your lives. Maybe you're here and you're a high schooler. Maybe you're in junior high. Maybe you're here this morning, you're a father or you're a mother. Or maybe you have clout with people that you work with. And let me ask you this. You want to become a spiritual leader? Do you want to do more than simply know God and know that you're on your way to heaven? Do you want to become one who is motivating others to strive to the perfection of living for God? You want to get these things down. Because there's a man who's living what he's telling us. So let's get into this. What are these factors in being a spiritual leader? First of all, a spiritual leader has a clear recognition of needs. A spiritual leader has a clear recognition of needs. Let's just look at the first phrase in chapter 1, verse 4 again. And it came to pass when I heard these words. The phrase is, when I heard these words. He had a clear recognition of the needs. Here's a man that was not living in a dream world. You say, I don't quite follow you yet. I'm saying this. I see many, many people today who never seem to ever see the problem that they ought to be solving. They don't see it. They don't see that there's a need there that needs to be met. And Nehemiah had a clear recognition of the need. He heard these words, and he did something about it. Why is it that people just don't seem to see the needs that need solving? I think one of the reasons is, let's use the word preoccupation. They're too preoccupied with everything else. Are you ever around a preoccupied boss? Or did you ever have a preoccupied teacher at school? You know, you go to them, and let's put it in a teaching situation. And you ask the teacher a question, and this is a question that you know the rest of the class is thinking too, because the teacher hasn't made it clear. And you ask them, and you say, I don't understand this, and there's a problem with this, could you please explain it? And they kind of look at you, and, problem? I don't see a problem with that. In other words, they've got it all solved in their mind, and so they never see that someone else might not be understanding it the same way. Let's bring it home a little bit more. You ever have a preoccupied wife or husband? You come in. We won't be hard on either of the two, but I've got to make a distinction here. Okay, the husband's sitting there in the chair, reading the paper. The wife comes in. Says, honey, I need to talk with you about something that happened today. Uh-huh. Through the paper. It's leaking in the other room. It's running on the floor. Uh-huh. Honey, I really think you ought to come look at it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're totally preoccupied with what they're reading. And you can't hardly get their attention. You almost pull the paper down. Hello? You know what I'm talking about? They're preoccupied. Now, what I'm saying here is many times spiritually we are so preoccupied in so much that we are missing it when there is a need that needs solving. Someone in our family or a friend or something here at church, and there is something going on and we're too preoccupied with other things to do anything about it. And here's Nehemiah, and he says, what is the problem? And they told him, and he listened. Let's be a little more honest this morning. Why is it sometimes that we stay preoccupied with other things? Could it not be because sometimes we would rather avoid what we know would be coming? We don't want to have to face the situation that we know is really there. Maybe we say, I hate to mess with trouble. I don't want to touch that stuff. Or sometimes, if we're honest, we simply say, you know, I'm not near as interested in that problem as what I am in these other things. These other things are much more, I'd rather much more think about these other things. But a leader is one who has a clear recognition of needs. Let me ask you this. Are you conscious, are you aware of what's going on within your own family? Within your own people that you work with? Are you aware of their needs? Are you conscious of what they're hurting for and hurting with right now? How about you teachers? How about your Sunday school classes? How interested are you in those people that you teach? Are you interested in what they're doing and what's going on in their lives? I think of a father over in Illinois, and it just breaks my heart because I know him. And I see him, he is losing his family because he is out of touch. He lives in the same house. He eats the same meals with him, but he's out of touch. He is totally oblivious to what is going on with his kids. And why is it? He is preoccupied with things that he is interested in rather than where the real needs are. Now Nehemiah comes along and he said, I heard the words. I was listening to what was being said. Listen, this life is just flying by. And someday we're going to look back and we're going to say, what in the world did I do? Man, we've been talking for these past few weeks about what we're going to do this coming year. And some of you have made very definite decisions this year already. And I've had to look back on this past year. What have we accomplished here at church? Where are we going? What are we going to do? And sometimes, I have to be honest, we look back and we say, we haven't done a thing for months. And why is that? Is it not because, me included, we get so preoccupied with other things that we lose sight of what is really important? And where are the needs? And what needs changing in our own lives? Or do we say, I don't want to fool with that. That hurts. I'd rather stay away from it. Nehemiah said, I heard. I listened to what was there. Let me give you a second characteristic of a spiritual leader. A spiritual leader is going to become personally concerned about those needs. He's got to become a listener to where he understands where the need is. Secondly, he's going to become personally concerned about those. It's going to become his problem. It's not just a problem, but it's going to become his problem. Look at the next part of verse 4. I sat down and I wept. Listen, after he heard it and he understood what the problem was, he wept over the ruins. What is the typical response? What do we find ourselves when someone comes to say and say, this is the problem, this is the situation? I think Nehemiah, if he would have been a typical person like us, he would have said, what? The walls are broken down. Well, who's responsible for this? Who did this? Give me some names. I want names of who is responsible. Let's get to the bottom of this. That's not what he did. Rather, he said, it breaks my heart. He became personally concerned over it. Commentator Alan Redpath said this, you will never lighten the load for someone else until you have first felt the pressure yourself. You will never lighten the load for someone else until you have first felt the pressure yourself. He's simply saying this, you cannot remain aloof. You can't just look at a faraway thing when it is something that you're not being a busybody. We're talking about problems that you are having with people that you are involved with people that you ought to be leading. You cannot remain aloof from that, but rather Nehemiah was drawn into it and he felt the load that those people were bearing back in Jerusalem and he began to weep. And the next phrase in verse 4 says, he wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. As he began to feel the load and he began to weep, he began to fast and to pray. He was moved by what was happening. It became, here it is, show you how involved he got when he saw a need within his realm that he could do something about. That was, he became so moved by it that it became more important to him than food and drink. Let me elaborate on that a little bit. Has a spiritual need in your family ever been bigger to you than filling your stomach? When you see someone in your family that has a need in their life, or maybe you know the need is in your life, are you broken over that enough that it becomes bigger than putting food in your stomach? What does it say? Nehemiah was so broken over this, he fasted. Food wasn't the important thing anymore. The normal routine was broken up because he was pulled into this problem. He was personally concerned about the needs. Let me give you a sad story. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 3. Here's the cute little story that we all learned when we were kids, where little Samuel has been brought to the temple. He gets to stay with Eli. Little Samuel lays down one night and he hears, "Samuel, Samuel." Samuel gets up off his bed and scurries into Eli. He said, "Eli, you called?" Eli said, "No, I didn't call. Go back and lay down." Lays down again. Soon, voice comes, Samuel, Samuel. He gets up, he scurries into Eli. He said, "Eli, you called?" He said, "No." And we know that story and we think it's so cute and we learn how Samuel began to listen to God. But do you know what God told Samuel when Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth"? Look at what God tells Samuel. Verse 13. Well, let me give you a little background. Let's begin in verse 12. Here's what God told him. "In that day I will perform against Eli all things which I have spoken concerning his house, which I begin, I will also make an end. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knoweth, because his sons made themselves vile and he restrained them not." Two things I want you to catch in verse 13. Why is God going to bring judgment against this priest, the spiritual leader, Eli? Circle two words. Because he, in the middle, he knows the problem. He knoweth. But the end of the verse, he restrained them not. He knew his sons were living wickedly and he didn't do a thing about it. You see, how wicked were they? They were immoral. When ladies came to the temple, they were immoral with those ladies. That's how bad they were. And he didn't do a thing about it. And God says, "I'm going to bring judgment." I think Eli would fit the classic example of being more interested in his stomach than he was about problems. I don't think he fasted much. I don't mean to be sarcastic, but if you look in chapter 4, I'll show you what I mean. 1 Samuel. God says, "I'm going to bring judgment on him because he hasn't done what I've asked." You want to see how Eli died? A report comes in verse 12. "And there ran a man of Benjamin out of the army and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn, with the earth on his head. And he came to Eli, and lo, Eli sat upon a seat by the wayside, watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told all the city cried out. And when Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, 'What meaneth the noise of this tumult?' And the man came in hastily and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were dim that he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, 'I am he who came out of the army, and I fled today out of the army.' And he said, 'What is there done, my son?' And the messenger answered and said, 'Israel is fled before the Philistines, and there hath been a great slaughter among the people, and thy sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken.' And it came to pass, when he had mentioned the ark of God, that he fell from off the seat backwards by the side of the gate, and his neck broke, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy." I don't mean to be sarcastic, but I see a man who is overweight, never fasted, never worried about anything, and yet his kids died in sin. Now, all I'm saying here is that here was a man who failed miserably because he never personally got concerned about needs. You know, sometimes we know ourselves we're in sin. And it's no big deal to us. And it came back to haunt Eli. But Nehemiah is different. He's a man who's concerned personally with needs. So we see a leader has a clear recognition of needs. He recognizes the needs. He becomes personally concerned about them. Let me give you a third one. That is, a spiritual leader first goes to God with the need. When we see a need, what is our first response when we have a decision to make? Do we first say, well, I can work this out. I can do it. I've got the ability. And have you made decisions like that before only to have to regret them time and time and time again later? You see, prayer is an absolute essential. He saw the problem. He wept over the problem. It changed his schedule because of how burdened he was. The end of verse 4, he prayed before the God of heaven and said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awe-inspiring God who keepeth covenant and mercy for them who love God and observe His commandments. Let's notice his prayer back in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 4 and following. Let's notice what he did. First of all, he praised God in verse 5. He comes before God and he said, God, you are great and you are awe-inspiring and you keep covenant and mercy with them who love you. He said, you are the most powerful person in the absolute universe. Now that's saying a lot, because who does he work for? His boss on earth is Artaxerxes, who is no question the number one man in the whole world. He rules basically all of the known world at that time, the majority of it. And he works for a guy with all that power, and yet he comes before God and recognizes that God is the mightiest. God is the absolute mightiest. Listen, when you face a tough situation or you're up against a rock of a person that you're having trouble with, you realize that God is mightier than that problem and that person. I think you need to. You've got to realize, if you are not convinced that God is bigger than my problem and God is bigger than this person that I'm having trouble with, you're never going to find solutions. You've got to be convinced that God is almighty and He is all-powerful and He is powerful enough to handle the situation you're in. Nehemiah sees this. He praised God. Secondly, in verses 6 and 7, we see in his prayer, he confessed his part of the problem. Look at verse 6. Let thine ears now be attentive and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night, for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee, both I and my fathers have sinned. You see, he recognizes that Israel, Jerusalem, is in shambles, and part of it is his problem. He realizes that his sin is part of the reason why that place is in such ruins. And I like Nehemiah here, because he says, as a leader, I have got to be willing to admit that I am part of the problem. When there's a problem, we usually think of 6 or 7 ways that the other person has been stubborn and unwilling. And we have trouble getting around to our part of the problem. We seldom consider our ways. But Nehemiah uses terms, I and we, and saying, God, my family, I am part of the problem. I realize why we're in the situation we're in. Which takes us down to verse 8, and we see Nehemiah claim, he claims a promise. In verse 8, remember, I beseech thee, the words that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if ye transgress, I will scatter you among the people. Stop there. We've got two parts to this. He claimed the promise. In Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 30, he first of all recalls, he said, God, you have kept your word. Because you said if we got into sin, if we transgressed, you would allow us to be taken captive and to be taken to a foreign land. He said, you've kept your word. If you transgress, I will scatter you among the people. He said, God, you've kept your word. But look what he does in verse 9. He says, but God, you also said that if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though they were of you cast out into the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I scatter them from there. Excuse me, I will gather them from there and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name. He said, God, you told if we sin, we get taken into captive, and you've kept your word. He said, now keep your word, because you also promised, Lord, that when we got in there and we confessed our sins, you would allow us to go back. Now, he claimed the promise. He's in essence saying, well, God, I see you've kept half of it. Now I'm waiting, because I know you'll keep your word to do the other half. You'll allow us to go back. Listen, God doesn't give out promises lightly. If God gives us a promise in His Word, He doesn't do it carelessly. When God gives a promise, He says, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. God's not fooling around. God says, if you live in sin and you never turn from your sin, you're going to live eternally in hell. And God's not being harsh. He's stating a fact. But God also gives a promise, and He says, for those of us that have received Jesus Christ and serve Him, He says, seek ye first my kingdom, and all these things I will add unto you. And God keeps His word on that too. Nehemiah believed God's promises. Therefore, he makes a request in verse 11. He says, O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who delight to fear thy name. And prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. I want you to notice a phrase right in the middle of that. He says, he asks the Lord, he says, and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day. His request of God is, God, I ask that you make me successful. That's bold. And let me tell you something. We have absolutely no right asking for God to make us a success until we come to the place where we are right with Him. When we are like Nehemiah and we say, God, we've got a problem. I am part of the problem and I confess that. When we get to that place, we can begin to pray, God, make me successful today. Please, God, work in me and through me and use me that we can be a success. Listen, can you go to God with your problems today? Are you on asking terms? A leader goes to God first. Let me give you a fourth one. That is, a spiritual leader is available to meet the needs himself. He makes himself available to meet the needs himself. He saw the need. He had compassion. He got involved. He prayed to God and got his life straightened up. And we now see, so what happens when he prayed and confessed and everything is right? You say, boy, I bet God just opened the doors of heaven and just dumped a load of blessing on him instantly, right? Wrong. What happens? Look in Nehemiah 1:1. We need to get a setting of time here. Notice when he begins to write chapter 1. Came to pass in the month of Chislev. Okay? They had a different names for their months. That is our December. Okay? He gets straightened up with God. He confesses the sin. Everything. He gets back on track in December. And you say, okay, God, what are you going to do? He gets up the next morning and nothing happens. He gets up the next morning. Boy, God, I'm ready. Let me have it. Silence. A week goes by. Nothing. 2 weeks go by. Nothing. A month goes by. Nothing still. Until we come to chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king." Nisan is the equivalent of our April. He waited for 4 months. He was right with God, and yet God was silent for 4 months. God was preparing him. God was preparing him and teaching him. That's why God was making him wait. You see, God's timetable is not our timetable. And what God, sometimes we get right with God and God just opens the doors and boom, He gives it to us. And that's His privilege. And we rejoice in that. Other times, He doesn't. But that's His privilege as well. And he waited 4 months, but God was using that 4 months to get him ready for what he wanted him to do. And what is that preparation time? What did he learn during that 4 month wait? Number one, he learned changing hearts is God's specialty. Changing hearts is God's specialty. You see, he's got to get the king ready to let Nehemiah go rebuild the walls. He comes to the king. This is 4 months. He's been working for the king. He has not said a word to the king yet because timing's not right. And finally, it says, at the end of verse 2, he went into the king, and the end of verse 2 says, "Now I had not been sad in his presence." In other words, for these 4 months, I had not been walking around sackcloth and ashes, trying to get the king's attention so that he'd finally talk with me. Didn't do that. But it does tell us in verse 2, 4 months later, though, the king asked him, he said, "Why is thy countenance sad, seeing that thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of the heart." He said, I can see in you something that's down deep is really working at you. Tells us at the end of verse 2, he says, "Then was I very much afraid." He was scared. And I like to see that. Nehemiah admits, he said, "When I go before this guy," he said, "I am scared to death because of what I'm going to ask." He tells the king his displeasure in verse 3. He said, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city and the place of my father's sepulchres lieth in waste and its gates are consumed with fire?" He said, "King, I'm heartbroken over what I hear about my people." In verse 4, the king said unto me, "For what dost thou make request?" He said, "What do you want, Nehemiah? What would you like to do?" Nehemiah says, the end of verse 4, "So I prayed to the God of heaven." He prayed again. He had this saturated in prayer. He's learning that changing hearts is God's specialty. He couldn't twist the king's arm. He prayed. And you know, I believe when we have situations, we've got to make sure our lives are in line, but then we start praying for another person when we've got problems with that other person. We start communing with God about that, and we let God begin to work on that person until they're ready to talk. He says, "I want to rebuild the walls," in verse 5. He said, "I pray, if I have found favor, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, into the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it." Verse 6, "And the king said unto me," the queen was also sitting by him, "For how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. "Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the rivers, that they may let me pass through till I come into Judah, and a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace, which is near to the house, for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. The king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me." Why was God preparing him? What was happening in those 4 months? First thing was, he had to learn that God was changing the heart of the king. But secondly, and this is very important for us this morning, that is, prayer and preparation go together. Prayer and preparation go together. You see, he was not just sitting on his hands for those 4 months. He said, I cannot move until the king is ready to let me move. But in the meantime, because by faith he knew God was going to send him, he made proper preparation for when the time came. Now get this. People of faith need orderly lives and minds. People of faith need orderly lives and minds. Faith is not a substitute for planning. Did you get that? I think we fall into a ditch many times on that because we want to live by faith, we don't make any plans. And that is not what God teaches in His Word. We've got to be people who make plans and have orderly lives. He told the king at the end of verse 6, he told him how long he planned to be gone. He had already thought that through. Secondly, in verse 7, he asked for papers in order to pass through those territories coming up. He had already thought through, okay, I have to pass through this area, this area, and I've got to have papers if I'm going to get through there. So he had been making preparation. He had already thought through in advance. Listen, in our lives, many times circumstances will only let you take a little teeny tiny step toward where you want to be. That's all you can take right now. But being people of faith and believing God is going to open the door, we ought to be having 12 steps already planned out when God does open that door. We ought to be ready to move. Nehemiah was making preparation. He was a leader. He thought through in advance. He was prepared for what God was going to do. That is not a lack of faith. That is faith in action. God's going to do this. He made preparation. I had a man who was preaching one time make this statement. And you think it through. If you don't misunderstand what he's saying, it makes perfect sense. This is what Nehemiah is saying. That is, you prepare as if it all depends on you. But you pray knowing that it all depends on God. You make preparation like it depends on you. But you pray knowing the fact that it really all depends on God. And you've got to pray that way. See, that's the balance. That's the balance. Nehemiah was a leader who was available to meet a need because he got his life in line with God and let God clean it up so that he could be available. That's what he wants from us. Let's bow our heads.